There's a town in England that had a wisdom and a foresight that we could have profited from in the United States. 75 years ago, they foresaw the ecology crisis we're trying to struggle with now. And they had a town meeting to see what they could do to ward it off. And almost at the start of the meeting, with nearly no debate and nearly no opposition, they banned the combustion engine as the single gravest threat to the quality of their future life, their environment, their health, their air. From that date to this, no car, no bus, no truck, no van, nothing, no cycle has been allowed in the town. Their problem was, once they banned the combustion engine, what were they going to use to transport themselves and to transport their goods? And they went back and forth over every possible alternative, and near the end of the day, they settled on what they've been using for the past 75 years. They settled on the donkey. And because it is the only real means for them to transport themselves and the only real means to transport their goods, the donkey plays a crucial part in their environment. So that if you visit this town and you look carefully enough, you'll find that the most senior man in town has his own ass. He has to. The youngest lady in town has her own ass. She has to. And considering how important their asses are to people, they're pushing their ass, and they're pushing their ass, and they're pushing your ass. Now, their experience is that if you push your ass too hard, it breaks down on you. You people are laughing because you've probably never thought of, like, what would your life be like without your own ass? Problems back up very, very quickly. So being very practical, they borrow somebody else's ass. Now, has anybody else's ass ever moved fast enough for you? So they try to prod it along. Well, people don't like to have their ass kicked by a stranger. So this leads to many fights. Young gals are the same everywhere, and you'll find a young gal parking her ass where it doesn't belong. And the local cop has to come along and pinch it, purely in the line of duty. You can imagine how much peddling ass there is in this town, solely to keep the economy going. Once a year, everybody parades their ass in public. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever been deep into asses, but they're not all the same. And they pick the best-looking ass in town. Now, asses may differ, but politicians don't. And the day of the contest, you find the local mayor kissing ass for votes. I mean, it just makes... Well, there is an event that underlies my sharing. On a particular Sunday, of course, everybody hauled their ass off to go to church. Right in the middle of the Catholic Mass, an earthquake struck the town. Well, of course, everybody ran out of the church to save their ass. Except for the priest. He had tied his ass to a tree on the side of the church, and he noticed the windows were broken there, and he hoped to jump through the broken window and land on his ass. What he didn't know is that was exactly where the main crevice of the earthquake was, and as he jumped, he fell into the crevice, proving even a priest can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. And I got here because I am a Catholic priest who couldn't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. Now, if the joke offends anybody, I'm sorry. I graduated from a public high school in Penn State before I went into the seminary. And my own experience of the God that I found through the program as a priest is a God who enjoys fun. And as long as no one is unnecessarily hurt, I don't think something like that in any way is in poor taste. If you feel it is, I'm sorry, but I probably have a few more things you're going to feel in poor taste before I completely finish. I want to just thank everybody who's had anything to do with my being here, our being here. It's been, I'd say it has to be one of the warmest receptions I've ever had. And I'm a little bit under the weather this evening, so if I'm not bouncing, I hope I don't bounce too much, for people who know what's hit, if I seem a little stale, it's good. but we have been hearing Joe tell one story after another revealing the deepest secrets of all of the lives of people connected with the convention. And I'm happy to be able to do the National Enquirer expose on Joe and his wife, Libba. Their marriage is not what it seems like. I mean, I hate to have to tell you that they have had some pretty stormy times. And years ago, in the midst of one of their worst fights, Joe went storming out of the house, and he went down and he bought a cemetery plot. And then he went over and he bought a tombstone just for Libba, and he had carved on there, "Here lies Libba, frigid as ever." Well, word got back to her about this. And she heard about it, and she fumed, and she fumed, and she fumed. And the next day, she went down, and she bought a tombstone and had it put right next to hers, and on it she had carved, "Here lies Joe, rigid at last." What goes round comes round. 2 women are in the post-delivery room of this hospital. One a very haughty, rich woman, and the other a rather poor, just plain, simple woman. The rich woman has just had her second child, the poor woman her first. The rich woman walks over and she says, "This is my second child. After I had our first, my husband was so pleased, he went right out and bought me a 6-carat diamond ring." "That's nice." "And that wasn't enough. He bought me a full-length mink coat." "That's nice." "Through a sonogram, we determined this child is going to be a boy. And he's promised as soon as I get home, we go out and he will buy me a powder blue brand new Mercedes." "That's nice." "Well, didn't your husband do anything for you?" "As a matter of fact, he did. As soon as he found out that I was pregnant, he stopped eating lunches, and he saved all of his money, and he sent me to finishing school so I'd be a better mother for our child." "Did they teach you anything at finishing school?" "Yeah. They taught me instead of saying, 'screw you,' to say, 'that's nice.'" Now, as we all know, no one speaks for AA, and what I hope I'll share are just my own views. And in case you disagree with them, that's nice. I'm giving a new talk today. I like to speak from where I'm at right now. And I like to kind of put it in a certain order. And many, many things have been happening in my life, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to come out. So that's another reason I'm a little less peaceful than I usually would be. The background of my sharing, incidentally, I used to feel great pressure talking to a group this large because I thought I had to give something to everybody, and I hope I can. But I had the honor of meeting Don P., a former trustee at large, who was helped by this, and he passed it on to me. And I believe it, I really solidly believe it. If I'm here today, it's because God knows there's one person here that needs me to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And my gift tonight is, my duty tonight is to take the gift of me and offer it to that person. I hope all the rest of you can benefit from this. But I would say we could take our fellowships and we could divide us into alcoholics and Al-Anons. And then we could take our fellowship and we could divide us another way between those who feel we belong and those who at the gut of our being have never really felt that we belong in this universe. And that spans both Al-Anons and alcoholics. I love the mountains. I was raised in the mountains of Pennsylvania. I go to the mountains in the winter, and I go to the mountains in the summer. And about 3 years ago, the experience that underlies my sharing with you occurred at Aspen in the summer. I was up on the top of Aspen Mountain, and I came upon a wild field of dandelions. And they were large, and they were right between yellow and golden, and they were beautiful. And I'd like to paint a picture for you where God is intending to plant a garden. And it's so neat here at Callaway Gardens and all of the flowers that you are so blessed to see in your state, so many more than in our dry, hot Oklahoma that we have. And God plots out this garden, and it's like a jigsaw puzzle, perfectly balanced in its colors and its shapes of the flowers. And he gets down to one last spot, and he needs a flower that's going to have small petals. It's going to be 2 to 3 to 4 inches tall, and it's going to be not yellow and not gold, but right in between. And he designs the dandelion, and it is just perfect to complete his jigsaw. The trouble is that men looked at that flower in God's world, and they labeled a flower that God created as a flower, they labeled it a weed, and they tried to eliminate it from their world. And the pain about that is that some of us in this room grew up and feel like dandelions. We feel like dandelions who somehow are supposed to look like roses in shape, have the color of lilies, have the height of carnations. We struggle to become anything and everything that we are because we just don't have the right to be a dandelion. And without any doubt, that clearly is the group into which I was born and to which I spent most of my life, and the group in which any time my own natural forces take over, I belong. It's as if big petals are what everyone around me has, and my petals are small, except it's the opposite. I do have a card, and for once I'm speaking a little bit early, and if you have an opportunity to be near me and want to see it, I have a picture of me 7 years old, and my ears stand straight out, and they're about this big. And I went to school. I grew up being called Big Ears and Dumbo. And I learned to feel that what I was ugly. 10 years sober, I'm 55 years old now. I don't know if I gave my standard introduction, and my sponsor wants me to. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or mood-changing chemical today, or any today since May the 21st, 1972. And I'm very deeply grateful for that. But I'm 55 years old. I was 45 years old, and I had never once been able to picture my own face in my own mind. I blotted it out. I rejected what I looked like because that was ugly. That was dandelion, and dandelion was wrong. And if you feel like a dandelion and a dandelion is a weed, if you're like me, there is simply nothing in your power that allows you to live at peace, to become anything else. And yet you can't be yourself. I didn't have the peace to be myself. I went into therapy a few years ago, and I realized through the therapy something I should have realized a long time before that. I don't have a single memory of ever crying in my life. I remember my mother saying, "You cry and I'll give you something to cry about." I don't have the freedom to act on anger. I have the freedom to feel anger. Some Al-Anons I've met don't even have the freedom to feel anger. I can allow the feeling in me, but I cannot allow myself to believe that you see it, that you know it, or that it's being expressed. Much more sadly, I can't enjoy life. I remember being at a conference 3 or 4 years ago, and I watched some people let loose the way there's been such joy here. And at that particular moment, what I looked at and I said, "Isn't that childish?" And thank God I was in the program long enough to immediately say yes, and how I wish I had the freedom to be a child and to feel my feelings. I was not allowed to feel I could blossom and bloom with my feelings. They have to have a governor on them. And I have to live my whole life in an area that is so flat. And that meant that at the age of 21, I stood at my dad's grave. He had been killed in a coal mine accident. And I felt a little tinge of guilt for feeling absolutely nothing. And I didn't know that I felt nothing because I wasn't allowed to feel. Because to feel for me was to be a dandelion. And I was not to be a dandelion. I was never encouraged to have any practical thinking. I was encouraged to have book thinking, the only area where I ever achieved anything before our program. But anything I ever did was wrong and not good enough by way of fixing anything. I was 47 years old before I ever changed a tire in a car, and it was a major accomplishment. I've put about 500,000 miles on cars, and I've not known where to put the oil or the water. And it's because I feel totally paralyzed when I go to open a hood because I'm not right. I've been so crushed in this area of my life. Only through the therapy have I discovered, and this is only in about the last year or 2 years, that I was nearly absolutely emotionally abandoned as a child. My father never ever told me he loved me, never showed me a sign of affection that I have any memory of, and he was gone most of my life out of the house simply because my mother was too strong. My mother was a workaholic with an alcoholic personality, and I believe she really wanted to have time with us, but she pushed us outside till she got her work done, and of course she never got her work done. Outside it was my older brother with my younger sister, and I had stolen my older brother's love from my mother. I stole his birthright. I have nothing to do with it. And he hated me, and he could get my sister as an ally. And my options were to be alone or to be with others in pain, and I opted to be alone. And I'm still basically fighting a tendency to feel the safest thing in life is to be alone because I can't be hurt. But it's also the deadliest thing, as I've seen from my mother, who's lived it the last 20 years and become one of the most emotionally sick people I've ever seen. And in my gut, I've never felt anybody wanted me. Through an accident of environment, there was no one my age in my neighborhood. So I was emotionally abandoned by friends. I went to school in a Polish ghetto, and almost everybody else in my class lived in that ghetto, and I didn't. They were together all the time, and I wasn't. And nobody paid attention to me. Nobody disliked me. I'd have thrived on being disliked because it was attention. I remember the sadness of the Charlie Brown Valentine special. I doubt I'll ever watch it a second time. When he goes looking for the Valentines, I've lived that. And I got so few because nobody knew I was there and no one cared. And it's just like, I honestly don't belong. You all are flowers and I'm a weed. And I don't know what to do. My therapy made me reveal to me that I was sexually molested by my mother. I have a sister born 20 months after me. My mother was determined. My mother's a very strong woman. She would not have two children in diapers. I was toilet trained at the age of 18 months. And that's about as anal retentive as you can get, except for the night. You now have an inkling as to what my problem is. A very kind doctor gave me a short-term solution for a long-term problem. And after my sister was born, my mother was nursing her. And I guess I just had that basic envy, and I wanted to be nursed again. And my mother was in a fit of anger. She picked me up, threw me between her breasts, and smothered me there, screaming hate. And I have had emotional hang-ups with women breasts and nursing from that date on. But as a clergyman, the one thing I nearly cannot do is go into the nursery of a hospital. Naked women don't upset me, but the thought of a woman nursing somehow is going back and triggering that. And I didn't know anything why. I felt guilty because I just didn't go to nurseries. Now I understand why. My mother added on much other sexual abuse in a different way. It made me just feel that everything I am sexually is dirty, evil, and sinful. And that's me. It's like, how can the dandelion not be golden? That's a part of me, and it's an integral part of me. And I learned to think it was wrong. I tried everything I could to be part of life. Nothing worked except a fantasy world where I was every other different kind of flower. I'd have the freedom to look like I thought others should look, to act in feelings like others acted, to think practically, to be athletic, to belong, to be the center of life. And that didn't really work. At the age of 16, I found the only answer that worked for me. I started drinking in a bar in a coal mining town in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And we're not experts. We have our own guesses. Science may laugh at us all. I think each of us, the first three speakers in the AA program, voiced it a little bit differently. I certainly do believe I was alcoholic before I ever took my first drink. I'm going to say this, and it doesn't make any difference if you don't agree with it, because neither of us are experts. I believe I am not responsible for my disease. My parents are. I believe my alcoholism flows from a set of genes and an environment, and my parents contributed both of those. But I am responsible for my treatment. An example of that is I have other diseases. One is glaucoma, a pressure disease of the eyes that can lead to blindness. I'm not responsible in any way for my glaucoma. I believe it comes from the genes I inherited. But it would be tragic if, because I'm blaming my parents for the genes, I didn't take the treatment day by day, putting the drops in and went blind. It would be equally tragic if, because I'm blaming my parents for my disease, I don't take the treatment that will allow me one day at a time not to allow my alcoholism to explode in my life. But alcohol was my answer from the first drink. Instantly. I've listened to some heroin addicts, and my first drinking experiences produced a rush higher than anything else I ever had in my life. It was as if I had bubbles flowing through my veins, and life was exciting, and life was worth living. And I don't know what I was, but I was not a dandelion. I was not a weed. I belonged. I never believed I was good looking, but the way I felt it is as if when I took a drink, there was an inner glow, a charm in me, and you looked at that and you didn't look at my looks. So that it didn't make any difference how I looked, you wanted me. And I was a charming, delightful, life of the party, happy person in my early drinking. The other thing I didn't mention is I've never felt I belonged to any group in my life, except before AA, except for the first group I took a drink with in Pennsylvania. I belonged to that group. I wasn't on the outskirts trying to belong. Alcohol had taken me a weed and made me part of a flower garden, and it allowed me to live. I believe I would be crazy today or dead if I had not discovered alcoholism. I believe my alcohol is the treatment for my alcoholism, and it allowed me to walk through pain. Caritha said something last night, and I want to tell you this so you understand even some of our differences. She talked about when she got sick and tired of being sick and tired. I want to tell you, at the age of 14, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I had never yet taken a drink or a drug. And for the next 22 years, I found an answer and then lost an answer. And the only reason I'm here is, for some reason, I couldn't do what she did. I couldn't make a real suicide effort. I prayed that some drunk would cross over the turnpike time after time after time and kill me. I was 10 years sober before I ever wanted to take another breath. I had had long-term peace, but you see, I still felt I didn't belong. And as long as I didn't belong, then this feeling of serenity cannot last. This moment's okay, but I don't want another, because it all may vanish and I will be back in that hell of being a dandelion in the world's flower garden, and I don't want to be there. Alcohol allowed me to feel my feelings and to express my feelings. It didn't really overcome my sexual inhibitions. They were far too strong. But it certainly ended my feeling abandoned and allowed me to feel part of a world. I began drinking at 16, and I drank whatever I could, and I got drunk all the time. I have never in my life put a drink down saying I'm done, satisfied, and walked away. I'm 20 years sober, and I still want to slug someone who does that. And thank God I heard a speaker from Southern California say that when I was 3 years old, because it enabled me to feel that's still an okay feeling. You know, that was my only friend for years. And I drank whatever I could, and I started Penn State. Let me jump ahead a moment, because you'll see this will explain something about my life. I have 10, 11, 12 years of college. I don't know. It's not important. But about 3 years ago, I was driving to give an AA talk, and I started going through my life, and it was interesting. The only memories I have of Penn State are memories that deal with drinking. The times I drank in the bar at the Penn State campus in my hometown where I went my first 2 years, and then the few times I was able to get drunk at Penn State my junior and senior year, because when you're a coal miner's son, you don't join a fraternity. I was underage the whole time I was at Penn State. I graduated at the age of 20. I never skipped a grade, but on our legal drinking age for anything in Pennsylvania at that time was 21. So I could only get drunk when it was available somehow, and I could go to a frat party and drink what they had there, or somebody else could get it. And it's fascinating. I won some many great honors at Penn State, and I almost never share this, but I want you to understand that how this helps me see my own alcoholism. I had the honor of being Phi Beta Kappa. I had the honor of graduating as student marshal for my college at my graduation ceremonies and being the only member of the College of Liberal Arts on the field taking my diploma from the president of the university. There was one student from each college. I received 9 fellowship offers. I accepted 3 fellowships and 1 honorary one. I don't remember any of that. I can tell you that from going to the papers and looking at it. I can tell you about the nights I drank. And the reason those are the nights I can tell you about is because all of the other days were days I was a dandelion trying to keep the world from knowing it. And the nights I drank were the nights it was okay to be Larry. I belonged in the world. And I graduated from there and I started my fellowship, my graduate study at the University of Wisconsin. And the first thing I can tell you of the only really thing about the University of Wisconsin where I spent a semester was the first bar I drank in legally, the Steins of beer. They never had Steins of beer in the coal bars of Pennsylvania. These nice big steins and the wine coolers I started drinking. And it was at that point I decided to go into the seminary, and the next semester was at Loyola University in Chicago, 4 months there studying Latin. The only thing I could tell you about that experience is directly across the street from my room, I remember this as clear as anything, was a liquor store. And I bought wine bottles and I had them on my ledge in a Chicago winter, so I always had cool wine to drink. And see, it tells me, I understand why this is all I remember. Because this is when life was life. And not a sham, and not a hiding, and not a trying to believe, and not a wishing I belonged, and not a wishing I was a rose or a daffodil or a tulip or something else. It was just okay to be Larry when I drank. And after that, I went into the seminary, and life was rough because for the next 5 years, if I had whiskey on my breath from September to June, they would throw me out of the seminary. And we would only be let out of the seminary, this was the old Catholic church, about 10 days a year during that school period. And I drank with as much as I could on those days. And I would come in wobbly, trying to stand as far away from the rector, the head of the seminary that I was in, as I possibly could so he wouldn't smell the wine. And again, I led my class all of those years, and the only thing I remember is those days drinking. Because those are the days when there wasn't a pain of being, when it was okay to be. They threw me out of the seminary 1 year short of being ordained to the priesthood for emotional problems. I don't know why they did that. Still don't understand. Let me tell you this joke. This elderly woman all of a sudden isn't feeling good. She goes to a doctor and she says, "Doctor, I don't feel right. Can you help me?" And he holds her head. And he looks, and he gets his tweezers, and he probes in her ear, and he says, "Ma'am, did you know you had a rectal suppository in your ear?" She says, "Oh, thank goodness." He said, "I just told you you had a rectal suppository in your ear." She said, "Now I know where my hearing aid is." So just in case you can't hear me too carefully, shake your head a little bit, and we'll help you get to the root of the problem. During the 3 years I was out of the seminary, my alcoholism really took off. I was able to drink. I taught in a high school in Baltimore, a Catholic high school, and again, the only memories are memories of drinking, but this was the time when drinking became super important in my life. I did my laundry next to a bar, and I became very close to a barmaid in that bar, and I was drinking Michelob beer at that time, and like I remember one time when I had 12 unopened bottles of Michelob sitting on the table and a bus to catch in a hurry ready to drown. I had my room lined with Michelob bottles, and these are things that social drinkers just don't normally do. I did the cream de menthe route so that everything that exited my body was green. For a considerable period of time, and I wasn't Irish, so I wasn't doing it for St. Paddy's Day or anything like that. I loved Southern comfort. I drank as much as I could, and I was drunk as often as I could. I got into the only accident I remember from drinking. I sideswiped a minister's daughter, and she wanted to call the police, and I just threw on all my charm because I knew I was drunk and got her not to do that and took care of her damages. But this was a long time before I even stopped drinking yet. And about this time, in little ways, I think some of the pain started coming in because I think in little ways already the alcohol was stopping to work. I'll get onto that in a moment, though. I was taken back in the seminary, and the Catholic Church went from like hell to heaven as far as being in the seminary in the 3 years I was out. You remember my saying, if we had a drop on our breath of alcohol from September to June, we were thrown out. I come back into the seminary, and in our recreational room, there's a Coke machine, and right next to it is a beer machine where you can get bottles of beer for a quarter. And it was like, hey, I'm happy I'm back in the seminary. They didn't turn that machine on all the time. The Coke machine was on all the time. They would just turn the beer machine on during recreational hours. And I would be in that recreational room an hour early. And I could drive off campus and get stuff whenever I wanted anyway. But it was just I was there and I needed it. I became a priest. And I never worried about my booze supply because I ordered the wine. I didn't like the wine we had. My pastor picked it. But we always had 52 bottles of wine. And, you know, I've celebrated Mass drunk. I've come in. I had no hours. I usually did the afternoon Mass. I'd be coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning and trying to be sure I didn't meet the pastor who would be going over to celebrate the morning Mass. All these things are just the progression of my alcohol. I told people this. I want to spend a lot of time on it. I was a social drinker, and I drank in the social in the Purple Bunny Club of Lawton, Oklahoma. Now, the reason I drank in the Purple Bunny Club is that I'm very considerate. I was in a military town, and it was during Vietnam, and guys were coming back from Vietnam, and they were badly hurt, and they needed to talk, and I was probably the most liberal clergyman in town, and I was the one who could listen, and that's all real. I rationalized in my mind that they would be uncomfortable in the cold quarters of a church rectory, so I took them to the Purple Bunny Club, where they bought the drinks, and I certainly didn't want to give scandal, so I wore an olive green suit and sunglasses the whole time I was in there. And drank everything I could, and they screamed their problems to me over the loud sets of music, and I screamed back my therapy at them. That was just what was happening. Incidentally, they closed the Purple Bunny Club after I sobered up. There's not a direct cause-effect relationship there, but it's a straight, pure, factual thing. Alcohol stopped working, and I mentioned the Purple Bunny Club as the best index. That didn't mean to me that I didn't get drunk. What it meant was, when I got drunk, I felt uglier, lonelier, dirtier, more isolated, and more crazy than I ever did sober. I wasn't drinking in the Purple Bunny Club, and I wasn't drinking in any club. I was drinking in the parish home. Then I was drinking upstairs in my room, and then I was drinking upstairs in my room with the shades down and the doors closed. And when I drank, nobody wanted me around. I lost all my friends. And it was very simple for me, after years in the program, to see when I'm acting ugly, I'm no longer feeling good. And I hated me. And I wished I were dead. That's very important to know. And I'd like to share that first with those of you who are Al-Anon. Out of love, you often feel the single most important thing is to sober up the alcoholic. I have a picture of hell. And it would be someone tying me down to a bed 20 years ago and just keeping me there with no alcohol out in my system. I would be catatonic today. I could not have lived without my drug or some other solution. My pain was too much. And so I needed something that would allow me to be at peace with myself. Thank God I had friends that showed me this the hard way, and I watch what happens to other people. I do take the inventory of other people. And let me clash, I don't want to get into anything controversial. The big book tells us to do this when it tells us to take our own inventory and tells us to do the resentment list. Read the resentment list. Mrs. Brown is resented because she's a snob. She snubbed me. That's taking someone else's inventory. But Clancy, I heard after his first time at Founders Day. And he came up to where I was, and he said that he had just been at Founders Day, and he said he strolled the cemeteries, and it occurred to him that our program is written in blood. We buried people to find out what we have to do, and we buried people to find out what we can't do. And then Clancy went on, so be very careful before you ever change a word of our literature. Well, I continue to listen to what people are doing. Because I can only learn through my mistakes or yours. And it may sound cold, but if they've got to bury one of us, I hope it's you. And if I don't learn from your lesson, it won't be you, it'll be me. But if I learn from your lesson, it will never have to be me. And I've looked at people. And when I was 1 year sober, less than 1 year, we had a man 8 years sober who never went back to drugging or drinking, who put a shotgun in his head and his mouth and blew his head off. His worst day sober was not better than his best day drunk, nor has mine been. My hell began when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My body was going through physical withdrawals for alcohol and drugs, and I did counter drugs and I did street drugs, but my drug of choice is alcohol, clearly. My body was screaming withdrawal, my emotions were screaming withdrawal, my mind was screaming withdrawal, my spirit was screaming withdrawal. And I just had to learn to walk through life. I believe our program is designed, among other things, to help a dandelion find its place in the world. The single most important thing for me to find myself today is never to put anything else that's happening in my life before my alcoholism. And I've done that by studying other people. I have been part of three people dying of cancer in the program. Two of them put working with others first, and they became two of the greatest people I have had the honor of meeting in my life to the day they died. Emanating peace. One of them I sponsored, and when her cancer returned the third time, she fired everybody she sponsored, and I watched her just shrivel as a person and become a shrew. And I have had to face the possibility of cancer twice recently in my sobriety. It wasn't there either time. But I've remembered these instances. And the first time I put the program first and had tremendous serenity. The second time I put myself first and was miserable as anything. If I'm to have peace as Larry, I have to remember the most important thing for me is my program and working with others. But the second step says I come to believe that there's a power greater than me that can restore me to sanity. And so often when I hear people in our programs talk, I hurt because they seem to feel it says that we can restore us to sobriety. And sanity begins with sobriety, but it involves so much more. Sanity for me is wholeness. And it means that God's power someday can allow me to accept myself totally as a dandelion, regardless of what the world says. And I need to believe that if I'm to have peace today, even when I still reject parts of me. I was 12 years sober and I discovered I had never had a relationship in my life. I froze emotionally at the age of 3. And at the age of 12 sober, I believe I was entering young adulthood emotionally, where I was capable of forming a relationship, but I didn't know how. And I picture many of us in our relationships almost like the scene between Adam and God in the Sistine Chapel, two hands meeting. The program puts you together, the program puts me together, and now we want to touch, but we don't know the rules. I don't know the rules. I know how to take pictures, prisoners. I know how to buy people. I know how to control people. I know how to be a slave, but I don't know how to be an equal. I don't know how to share. Because you see, I was emotionally abandoned. And I can't feel that you want me, and I've never learned the rules on how to feel you're going to want me. I would hate to be here thinking I'm never going to have a relationship. And my second step challenges me to believe I'm not only going to be a dandelion, I'm going to be a dandelion in that flower garden, and I'm going to be part of the rest of you. And that power is so strong. When at the age of 53, I realized I had never cried, I didn't give up. And I used a therapist, and at the age of 54, I shed tears in a men's group for the first time in my life. They were just little. I have 55 years of sorrow waiting to come out. But I honestly believe it's going to come out. That someday, that part of being the dandelion in my life will be okay, and I will be okay to feel those feelings. The third step, if I'm going to be free to be me, I'm not the answer. I can't find the answer inside the problem. I have to do what my sponsor tells me. Now, the speakers here have been dressing. Wouldn't make any difference if they were all real casual, because when I was 10 years sober, I spoke in my sponsor's home group. And you'll catch from this, my sponsor is not a marshmallow. And he threw me against the wall because I didn't have a shirt and tie on and a coat. And he told me, anytime I know I'm to be behind the podium, I honor you by dressing up. And please hear this as no critique of what anybody else ever does. This is my line of sponsorship. And as I shared after this, pardon me for mentioning another fellowship, but it makes it a little bit better. About 5 years ago, I had the honor, because of one of my other addictions, of talking at the Western State Regional Conference of Narcotics Anonymous in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And if you've ever been in the other fellowship, we're a different breed. Tank top is formal dress in NA. And this is over July 4th, and they're all running around like that, and I'm running around in shirt and tie and coat and pants. And I made a point when I shared with them that when I did what you wanted me to, I didn't belong and I never felt I belonged and I was isolated. When I surrender myself to the care of my God through my sponsor, I have the peace to learn to be me and to live at peace with me. And I have done that. My sponsor just recently, really 2 years ago, told me to inventory the two most erratic areas of my life, my finances and my sex life. And I hope in a moment I'll show you the results of that inventory. I put it off as long as I could because self-will run riot, box at investigation. That's one sentence I wish they would scratch from the 12 and 12. My life would be much easier if I didn't know that. But anyway, I do what my sponsor tells me. And when I do more and more, I know I'm being taken care of and I will reach the point where I can accept the fullness of who I am. Now, if I'm going to have peace, I'm not going to have it thinking I'm red if I'm a dandelion. Just because I'm in the midst of some roses that are red and I want to be like you. My peace can only flow from knowing my color right now, and that's where the fourth step inventory becomes so important. It has nothing to do with you. I can only have real peace, or anyone else, I can only have real peace at this moment by knowing who I am. And the longer I'm sober, the easier it is for me to believe my own press notices. And so it's important for me to know that I still charge things to the church that I shouldn't. Now, my sponsor has a very poor command of English, and he calls that stealing. Having discovered Roger's Thesaurus a long time ago, I prefer to call it padding the expense account. I think it has a much nicer sound. But I've got to see that there's still part of me that is a thief because I'm hurting and I have too much of a dependence on material goods. That pushed to a corner, I hold resentments, that I have other problems, and I may not like what I see, but I have to accept the person that I am right now. And then if I'm going to have peace, if I'm going to be this dandelion, I don't want to spend my life under a basket. I have to have the freedom to be me in your world, and that's what the fifth step gives me. When I go to one person and give myself as I am today, as a total gift to that person, and that's my sponsor, the end result of that is I have the freedom to be Larry. I don't have to hide myself. And I can offer myself to any single person on earth to the degree that they have a need with no shame and no pain. I'm not presenting my whole self to you because many of you wouldn't be able to take it and it wouldn't be a love gift. It would be a tidal wave. But if you come to me with a wave, I can go down as far in the elevator of my pain as you've gone down. And I hear some priests, and I'm thankful that all they were basically, as I describe it, is St. Joe with a drinking problem. That's not me. I stole every cent from the poor fund of the first church I was in as a priest for 3 years. And that was felony theft. I'll tell you clearly that amount. They don't make you saint of the year for doing that. But I can tell you that today because I've walked through that pain, and I've inventoried it, and I saw my own greed, and I've shared it with my sponsor, and I can share it with anybody who has a need. I borrowed a sheet of paper for the sixth step. I used to think, and let me describe the sixth step. I asked God to remove my anger. I asked God to remove my fear. I asked God to remove my envy. I asked God to remove my lust. And when he does it all, this will be me. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty willing to bet that it's about the way most of you saw the sixth step. I believe that is psychologically, biologically, and spiritually impossible to do. I believe there is something inherent in life that never wants to be less, that only wants to be more. And I can convince myself I want these things taken out. But that just can't happen. And nature abhors a vacuum. And if a defect is removed like that in my life, something worse pops out. Let me tell you what my understanding of this step is. I have discovered a God who is all love. And if I'm entirely ready to have God remove, not me, God remove these defects, that must mean I'm entirely ready to have God love. That means I, as a dandelion in a world that calls the dandelion a weed, strive for the effort to allow God to love me as a dandelion. I experience God's love at an AA meeting. And to the degree that I'm really experiencing love at a meeting, every defect I have is either moderated or gone while I'm at that meeting. When I come in and people are sharing their deepest pain, giving themselves to this meeting because they're hurting badly, I could have come in with greed or resentment or fear, and when I'm listening to that person give me themselves in love, my defects are on ice, and they're not there. And I believe that if I allowed God right now to love me with all of his love and to fill me out, not make me less, but make me more, let the dandelion blossom, every one of my defects would be unnecessary. And I definitely believe that with all that I am. If I had God's love so that I knew to the depth of my being the sacredness of who I am, there is no possible way I could treat any person on earth as a sexual thing to satisfy myself. If I knew how experienced, because I've had flashes of this, how rich I am because I'm loved by my God, I wouldn't need to amass a mountain of things to distract me from my emptiness. When I sense how giving my God is and how eternally patient my God is with me, I couldn't be demanding and impatient with you. And my sixth step is not making Larry less, it is allowing God to make Larry more. And in the doing, to shed defects. I often don't share this because it's embarrassing. We heard someone look down and because there was a priest be embarrassed about saying that she heard God talk. And I just was so with her because I've heard God speak twice. You may hear both of them today. The second time was a week after my fifth AA birthday. I had driven 140 miles to celebrate my birthday, had 100 miles more to go. Go driving back at night, was smoking three packs of cigarettes a day, had good butane lighters for the first time in my life, looking forward to smoke. And I heard God speak, and he said, you don't have to smoke now. And I've never had a cigarette since. I was already working the program of Overeaters Anonymous. I didn't eat a snack ever. I never put on any weight. I went through no nicotine withdrawal. And the absolute unbelievable thing is, I don't smell smoke. My sponsor at that time was not a very loving person. He was jealous. And I just thought about the funniness of this. He told somebody that it was easy for me to give up smoking because I never inhaled. I inhaled houseplants. I never smoked a cigar because the only way I knew how to smoke was inhaling, and I couldn't picture pulling that stuff down. I thought it'd just rot out my stomach. But that's what happens. I allowed that moment when I heard God's voice, I was thanking him for 5 years of sobriety, and I was filled with his love. And God's love just came in and got rid of a defect, and it was gone in my life. Why? Why, when God removes something so big, does he keep so many other things? Incidentally, I want to tell you something. AA has taught me about my God. I came here as an atheist. I had lost my faith the last year of being a priest. Because of what I was stealing, I didn't want there to be a God. And I didn't surrender to God. I surrendered to two people, then to a group, then to a program. And I woke up 2 weeks into the program with a peace experience. And I think mine came that quickly because I would have gone catatonic. The self-hate was so strong and the pain. And I knew there was something stronger than me. And I didn't call it any God of any religion because this worked and that didn't. And it took about 2 years of my allowing this God to lead me to say, this is the God that I find elsewhere. But basically what I discovered that I was doing and other people was, in churches, I would look at someone, and I'll just like take a pic, and I would look at Woo Woo. And I would tell him, we will love you if you're over here. We will love you if you stop stealing, and I'm changing now, not him, but we will love you if you stop being a prostitute. And in the program, I realized that if I'm telling him, we will love you if you move, what I'm really telling him is we hate you while you're there. Because those are the only two alternatives. And that's not the message of our program. We look at people who have broken every rule they've ever had, like me, and they walk in. And what do? We give ourselves to them in love. And through this, they experience a God of love. They find their own dignity, and they stop doing many of the things that they've been doing. And so the program helped me find my God. And the program again and again and again made me rethink my religion. And I don't want to shake any of you in any way at all. But I honestly believe that alcoholism is an incurable disease and sobriety is a miracle. It's a gift of God, and I don't think God works miracles for his enemies. I've had friends who have lived together, unmarried, and stayed sober. Obviously, God wasn't as upset with them as we clergymen are. I sponsored someone who was gay and who did a lot of tricking and stayed sober. Obviously, God had different values. But I will tell you something. There's a strange scene where I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I had a need and you came and you fed it. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. And it turns around. I was lonely and you didn't visit me. I was in the hospital and you didn't come to see me. And values are pronounced. I have never seen anyone stay sober without continuing to serve the needs of others. And that doesn't make any difference whether they're in wedlock or out of wedlock. Now, God's getting rid of my smoking shook me to the core, because in our church, smoking is not a sin. But some of the things I was doing sexually was. And I was shaken to the depth of my thinking, wondering, why did God tap me on the shoulder and get rid of a small thing by the values in which I was raised and leave a mountain there? And I didn't have an answer for that. Leave that one there for a moment, because it goes on to the seventh step. I was chairing a meeting, and a friend of mine was at the meeting, and we ended at exactly 9 o'clock, and we were on the seventh step, and we got to him 3 to 4 minutes before nine. And I said, "Harry, I'm sorry you don't have more time." He says, "I have all the time I need." And he told this story, but I'm going to tell it in my terms through his experience. He said, "I had one good molar left that I needed to chew a steak with, and I love a good steak. And it wasn't feeling right, so I went to see a dentist. That dentist opened my mouth. He looked in, and he says, 'Your tooth has a defect of character. It needs to be entirely removed.'" And Harry said, "I love steak so much, I am not entirely ready to have that defect of character removed, so no thank you." Closed his mouth, and he went home. A little later, unknown to him, he had an infection in the tooth, so that known to him, he was feeling his heart in the tooth. The next morning, when the dentist opened, Harry was in his chair, entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defect of character. The dentist looked in his mouth, opened it, closed it, gave him some pills, and said, "I can't touch that tooth. It has an infection. Take these pills and come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the tooth was still hurting. Harry was back. The dentist opened the mouth, shut it, and said, "Still infected. Pills, take them, come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the infection was gone, the pain was gone, and the dentist removed the tooth. At that point, Harry's reality and mine would have changed. I wouldn't go back to the dentist. But Harry did, and the dentist pulled the tooth. And I believe from Harry's story, just the wisdom, the simplicity of this enabled me to see so much. I come to God and I say, "Please remove this." And I don't know the spiritual and the emotional and the physical and the intellectual infections that are connected with this defect. And God says, "Take this meeting and come back in 3 days. And when I'm ready, he just pushes that defect out like it was never there. In his time, when he's ready. If I'm to be in my bed at peace with you, I have to allow you to be a flower, a different shape and a different color for me. And it's the eighth step that gave me that ability. I thank God got to meet Bob White, who helped me with this step. He was from Whitney, Texas. He died just before his 30th birthday of cancer, sober. And Bob pointed out to me, because I couldn't do this list, because I wasn't willing to make the amends. He says, "That step is written, made a list of all persons we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all." It doesn't say became willing to make amends to everybody we had harmed, and so we made a list. If it did, you'd have to be willing to make amends when you make the list. He says, "There's two parts to the step, just make the list." And I went and I wrote people's names, and I wrote what I did and why I did it. And I had one of the five great experiences I'd had of the program from that. And I was happy I did about a fourth of the things I wrote, and I wish some of the people were there so I could do it again. But what I discovered is, you have feelings. And I was so much into my own pain, I didn't know that. And let me tell you, from looking at meetings, I see so much of that. We can be so insensitive. Somebody comes in and will say, boy, you're putting on weight, aren't you? Let me tell you, in case you have never known this. Now, I'm Polish, so I got a right to be stupid. But long before you notice that I'm putting on weight, my belt has informed me of it. And I don't need your helpful hints. And it doesn't make anybody feel better. I hear some rude things. People will refer to old Joe or fat Joe. And we hurt each other. You see, I come to this fellowship with every single barrier down. Because here's where I expect to find love. And you have the power to hurt me deeper and quicker than anyone else on earth. Because when I walk out the room, I put my walls back up. I have to. Because there are snipers out there. But I don't expect the snipers in here. And I am astounded at meetings at how insensitive we can be. Someone will come over, shake somebody's hand, pass over the next person because they see somebody that intrigues them, and go shake another hand. And see, I know what it's like to be emotionally abandoned. And I die when I see that happen to me or someone else. And it's the eighth step that made me aware that when I'm working 1 through 7, I can stand in your presence and allow you to be a person, you. Let me quickly pass over 9 and 10. I want to get to 11 because I have several more things I still want to share with you that are deep to me, and it's very relevant to where I'm at now. The 11th step, prayer isn't important for me. Meditation is. 1 through 10 got rid of everything that made me hate being who I was. But 1 through 10 could not allow me to like, to accept who I was. That comes only through the 11th step, through meditating. My God is not truth. Now, God, great spiritual writers say, is both truth and love. So if your God is more truth and you practice something different from mine, again, please, I'm not critiquing you. But my God is love. And I don't know love with my mind. I know love with my heart. And my meditations are based on allowing me to experience what my God is feeling toward me. The very first one was a 2.5-year-old kid, scared of a thunderstorm, coming running and jumping in the arms of a loving authority figure. And that figure just puts the arms around. And that's exactly what happened when I came to the program. There were storms of life, and I was scared of hell. And I came running to you, and I jumped in your arms, and you put them around me. And the storm was still there, and I felt okay. I felt scared, and I felt okay. I'm going to talk long, and if it's too long, just go, because I have some deep things I want to share today. And given that, I still will need to say this. I have had the honor of hearing 500 to 1,000 fifth steps. I had the honor of being at West Texas Alateen, where there were 400 Alateens to 800, and they've been gathering for 15 years twice a year. And the people connected with that taught me reality. And they taught me that 60 to 80% of the girls raised in alcoholic homes are sexually molested by fathers and stepfathers, and 25 to 40% of the boys are. Since that time, and I hope I have not said it, I avoid the word father in prayer in our program. Because there must be such emotional baggage for so many of you. See, I have that with mother. I hope I will not be offensive now, but at one point, my relationships with the Catholic Church have been very painful, very often. And at one point, the term they use is Mother Church, and that's exactly what she was to me, a real bitch, just like my own mother, trying to wipe me out and keep me from being me in any way at all. We have to be so sensitive to the reservoir of pain that is here, because it is so very real. Anyway, that's why I just said loving authority figure, because I couldn't pick my mom or my dad. I wouldn't want my mother to put her arms around me for anything. She would strangle me. She would kill me as me. I jump in the arms of a friend of my mom, the only person in my childhood that ever noticed me and liked me. And she's been very important to me for that. She puts her arms around me. And that's what you did. And then I took this picture a little bit further. If you had a child, I learned something about God in this meditation. If you had a child 2.5 years old, born with a defective, shriveled leg, and he had just fallen asleep, and you were rubbing him to sleep, what would you have rubbed with the greatest tenderness and cried over with the warmest love? that defective leg. Because you would see how it would keep him from running with other children and all of the taunts and pains he was going to get. That day I knew that my God didn't hate my defects. My God had been rubbing them with tears for 50-some years. Because he saw how those defects would cause others to laugh at me and keep me from running freely with them. And I had a new experience, much more wonderful, of my God. Lately, my meditations have been the prayer of St. Francis, and I was intending to bring it here, and I didn't. So I may miss one or two things. And it's a matter of feelings, looking at the dandelion and at Larry. Lord, make me a channel of your peace. And it's all first what I have to experience. I just picture the peace that flows from an all-perfect God toward this garden, the whole and every part of it, and how God accepts me as a dandelion, how my God just accepts me as Larry. That where there is hatred, I may sow love. Love to me is what you gave me, total acceptance. My God is accepting me, and I need to feel that as me, as dandelion in the garden, as Larry here today, as the total person I am today. That where there is injury, I may sow your pardon. The world blames me for being golden. My God pardons me for being Larry. He pardons me for being alcoholic. He pardons me for being fear-filled. He pardons me for having a governor on my feelings. And my God just says it's okay to be Larry. That where there is doubt, I may sow your faith. At a meeting once where there was deep love, I just went into a meditation and I felt my God having 100% faith in me that I would be me. How could I not be? How can the dandelion open up and be anything else? That dandelion can never open up to be a carnation. No matter how much I try to be anything else, my God knows I'm going to be Larry. That where there's despair, I may sow your confidence. I even hear God laughing at my despair. Because the flower can't be flustered. It will not open 1 second, 1 day before it's supposed to. And when it does, it's going to be exactly what it's supposed to. And that's exactly me at every moment of my being. I'm exactly the Larry God wants me to be now. That where there's darkness, my own darkness, the darkness of the world, I may sow your light. See, I'm wanted. I'm not an accident. My God willed me. My God planned me. My God wants me to be Larry. He doesn't want me to be you. He wants me to be me. Where there's sadness, I may sow your joy. A nun had me do that once. She just pictured, gave me a song, pardon the use of the term, and the Father will dance. When I was born, God dancing for joy that I was in his universe now. And I need to feel that to the depth of my being before I can have any purpose. I have two more things I want to share with you. Second flows from this now, and still in the program. In Oklahoma, our farmers go into the fields in September, and they sow our wheat. In June, mid-June, they bring the reapers in, and that wheat will be 2.5 to 3 feet tall. It'll be golden, and it'll be headed out, and the fields will be full. If you go into the Oklahoma fields right now, in February, which month are we in? January still. If you go into the Oklahoma fields in January, it isn't going to be golden, it's going to be green. It isn't going to be 2.5 feet tall, it's going to be 2 inches tall. It's going to be scraggly as anything, and it won't be headed. That's the grain. It won't be headed out at all. Now, I have a picture of what I'm supposed to be at harvest time. I got it from nuns, I got it from the Bible, I got it from teachers. And I think that's what I'm supposed to be today. And I compare myself to what I am today to my picture of what I'm supposed to be at the harvest, and I'm constantly damning myself. But if the Oklahoma wheat were 2.5 feet tall in January, it would never make it to the harvest in June. Our winter winds would just shear it down. If it were golden, it would have mildew before it was ready to be harvested because of the kind of climate we have in the winter. That wheat is exactly the color, exactly the size, exactly the thickness, exactly non-headed out that it should be in God's plan. And God is either everything or he is nothing. He's either in control or he isn't. And see, I came into the program, and as I told you, I couldn't picture my own face. I'm going to give you some of the things I walked with. I was 3.5 years sober, and compulsive eating broke out. I'm one of these with a steady succession of compulsions. I was 5, and I handled that through another program. I was 5 years sober, and I got into one of the sickest relationships in the world. It was an Al-Anon relationship where my need to have somebody not abandon me made me get into a relationship with someone sicker than me, dependent upon me. And I needed to be in that because of my own sickness until I broke from it by getting healthier. 4-5 years sober, a nun taught me to hug myself. And it took a whole year. I see people do it quickly. When I touched me, I felt I was touching garbage. Today, when I hug myself, I think it's me and God hugging me. I didn't know it. I was 12 years sober and thought I hated me and hated my name. Someone I sponsor said, Larry, do you realize when you say your name, she listened to some of my tapes, it's like you're singing. And I realized that I have a peace. I thought I was dead inside. And at a moment when I needed it in Phoenix, I gave a talk and some people came up and talked about the sparkle in my eye. And it's not always there, but I know it's there now. And there's a peace and there's a God there that I didn't know was there. I was 5 years sober and God took away the smoking. I've had one difficulty after another removed. When I was 12 years sober at Jonesboro, Arkansas, after conference, someone started singing the Lord's Prayer and I pictured my face. I'd never done it in my life, and if I died that day, it would have been okay. Because you see, your love at first allowed me to accept what I was spiritually, then intellectually, then emotionally, and finally physically. 5 years later, I was in Irving, Texas, and my favorite speaker, Tom Iverson, was talking. And I was sitting in a straight line from Tom, well, from a mirror. I was in the front row. Right in front of me was a big mirror, and I had trouble listening to Tom because I was flirting with my looks. And it astounded me. I loved loving me, but I never thought I would like me. And I'd reached that point. 90 days ago, I was intervened on. And my sponsor had prepared me for this, for the sexual inventory. I want to say this so carefully, I'm going to keep it in a general way. Sadly, the American press has had a lot of scandal, and families have walked through tremendous pain with indiscretions by clergymen. My problems in this area involved no acting out. I am not saying, thank God I never, and I'm saying not saying, at least I never. Because if anyone here acted out in those areas, we understand, and you're still welcome here. And I don't want to make you feel apart from me. But I do owe it to my own church so that as I go into this area, my sexual compulsion had been alive for 19 years of sobriety. The last year and a half, it's like it was time for the harvest. And my peace started going. And I felt more like a hypocrite when I got up to share. Because inside there was a part of me that I felt no longer belonged. And I was flowing against the tide of the universe. And one person came to talk to me and I knew I was ready. Now, I had gone. You hear some people say that they get everything they need from a program. I wish I did, but I have too many addictions. And I have worked this program. I have heard Fifth Steps. I have sponsored. I have spoken. I have shared. I went to a therapist for additional aid, and the sexual addiction remained. I tried my sponsor in the program, and the sexual addiction remained. They cooperated, and the sexual addiction remained. I went to church and was as spiritual as I could ever be, and the sexual addiction remained. 90 days ago, I started going to another fellowship, and for 90 days, I have had absolute peace. No, one day I watched a little bit of some blurbs on television that I shouldn't have, not deliberately got myself a little bit aroused. But I've had 90 of the most peace-filled days of my life. I am in tune with the harmony of the universe. I know my God is in love with me, and it's a tremendous place to be. But that's not what I want to stress. If you're here struggling with something, if you're here sober in the program and you're walking with one of these secondary addictions and you're still sober, may I beg you to continue carrying the message in the program and to continue to grow and to search, because the answer will come your way in God's time when God is ready. 15 years ago, got rid of the smoking. I hope 90 days ago, God got rid for good of the sexual addiction. It has been tremendous peace. The last thing I want to share with you, maybe second to last. I'd like you in your own mind to try to picture the word or a story or event that most helps you understand your own God. Now, I got introduced to my God from the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I work in a church. And recently, one particular story in another book has been so meaningful to me. And I began to see that this story is my introduction to my God. And I want to tell you how sacred a part you have to play in it. And it's at a meal when the Lord gets up. And if you're not in a religion like mine, please don't be offended. hear the story, and then you can make your own applications independent of it. But the Lord gets up, and he takes off all of his clothes. He sheds all of his dignity except for a towel around his waist. And he goes and he does the most one of the most humiliating things at that time. He starts washing his friend's feet. So humiliating that you couldn't ask a slave of your own religion to do that at that time. You could do it to a pagan slave, but not one of your own religion. Now let me tell you why that is my introduction to my God, because that's exactly what you did to me. I came feeling filthy and isolated. And you stripped yourself of all dignity, and you didn't tell me the great successes that you had achieved. You told me your pain. You told me your failure. You told me getting drunk when you didn't want to. You told me the things you did to your family. You told me how you had broken your standards of honor, so that when I had broken every standard of honor I did, including revealing things told to me in counseling confidence, I could still feel okay. You stripped yourself of your dignity the way the world doesn't to wash me clean. And that's still my strongest introduction to my God. And it's an interesting scene, because the Lord comes to a friend of his and he's washing the feet of people who are all going to run from him. They're all failures, every one of them. It doesn't make any difference. Because I believe he sees the dignity of a person independent of the actions. And isn't that true of what you did to me? I came as a total failure. And when nobody else would have me, you wanted me. You welcomed me. You shook my hand. You gave yourself to me to wash me clean. And when the Lord comes to one of his friend says, I don't want you to humiliate yourself like that. And he says, if I don't wash you clean, you have no part of me. And if I don't allow you to give yourself to me, if I don't make myself part of the fellowship, and I've cut myself off, I start forgetting the cleansing that you give me. What tremendous power you have. How you have introduced me to a God that I love to share with others. I can't picture a God that humiliates himself to wash me clean, ever punishing me or anyone else. I just picture that God hurting and crying the way we do when we see alcoholics getting drunk needlessly, family suffering needlessly, the pain and the shame and the death that's involved. I close with this. My second year sober, a biker told this story. It too is from non-conference literature. Jonathan Livingston Siegel. And he cried when he read it. Jonathan, the younger crowd that doesn't know the story of Jonathan, was a gull that wasn't limited by anybody else's expectations. He just flew higher than any gull had ever flown. And he comes back and there's some static, but he starts making converts. And the part you need to hear is Maynard comes limping across the sand with a broken wing. And he comes up to Jonathan, and Jonathan says, what do you want? And Maynard says, I want to fly. And Jonathan says, you can fly as high as you want to. And Maynard says, you don't understand, I have a broken wing. And Jonathan says, you can fly as high as you want to. And Maynard starts flying. I came to you crushed by alcoholism, by drugs, by sex, by breaking every rule I had, by feeling isolated, by thinking I was a dandelion in a world that didn't want me. And basically you asked me, what do I want? I wanted to fly. I couldn't even crawl. I think I'd have been content with crawling. And you told me I could fly as high as I want to. And it was such a freeing, livid, glorious message. But I really didn't believe it. But I did the things you wanted. And I started crawling. And then I started stumbling a few walking steps. Then I started walking. And then I started running. And at times I've flown. And I'm not near where I want to be yet. And I don't want to give you the impression I'm totally there. My finances are still a mess. And I'm still charging things I shouldn't. I still have vistas to free myself. I'm vistas to see as I continue to free myself. And I think I can do that if I will constantly bring myself back to you and open myself up so that you can wash me clean. I hope my sharing has helped you too. Thank you very much.
Name is Wilton, and I'm an addict.
Oh, alcoholic.
Sorry about that. Larry said, be yourself. Told y'all he was good. He kept me going like this all day. Part of the day, anyway. Joe Russell, you get the thing now? Clergyman, me? Yeah. No, he's from Auburn. I have to explain this to Joe. Any more? You got an announcement? Steve said they need a few minutes to set up the room and want everybody to go up to the restaurant, ice cream, and socialize. Y'all know how to socialize. That's what you used to do when you was drinking. But we don't want you to drink. We want you to just mingle, you know, and everything. If nothing else, I know that. Thanks, Joe. Let's end this meeting in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer.